I'm going to call our second case 08-AP-1700, Marilyn Arms Limited Partnership versus Carl M. Thomas. Arguing on behalf of Marilyn Arms is Attorney Randy Wynn for 15 minutes. Jankowski for the Apartment Association of South Central Wisconsin, Apartment Association of Southeast Wisconsin, Central Wisconsin Apartment Association, and Lakeshore Apartment Association for 10 minutes. Then Mr. Connell will have 30 minutes, and there will be 5 minutes in rebuttal by Attorney Wynn. Is that correct? Okay. All right. Mr. Wynn, you may proceed. You may proceed, but I will tell you as you're approaching the lectern, we are expecting approximately 40 children from an elementary school. They have not yet arrived. So if you hear a disturbance, it's the youngsters coming in. We won't interrupt the argument other than that disturbance, and depending where we are, I'll then introduce them. Counsel, you may proceed. And I'm sorry for any disturbance that may occur. Go ahead.
That's quite all right, Your Honor. Thank you. And good morning, Chief Justice Abramson. And good morning, other justices of the Supreme Court. My name is Attorney Randy Wynn. I represent Marilyn Arms Limited Partnership. This case is not complex. This case does not involve expert witnesses. It involves a simple interpretation of the Wisconsin statutes regarding landlord-tenant law and whether or not the landlord in this case and in other cases, as will be discussed by my co-counsel, has the right to contract for an expansion of, but not contradiction of, an express provision of the Wisconsin landlord-tenant law. In this case, the facts as stipulated were very simple. A young lady entering college rented an apartment from my client. She went to bed at night, left her hairdryer plugged in, presumably off. When she woke up, the apartment was on fire and caused over $8,000 of damages. Fortunately, no one was personally injured. However, the apartment was destroyed.
If the apartment was destroyed, I assume that it was uninhabitable.
That's
correct.
Yes. And in fact, in this particular circumstance, Justice Bradley, the tenant was relocated to another apartment owned also by Marilyn Arms. At the conclusion of the tenancy in the apartment complex, after the tenant left, the landlord sued, said, "Tenant, you are responsible for repayment of the damages under the express provisions of multiple provisions of the lease. You are responsible to restore the premises to the condition that it was in prior to the time that you rented it. It was your hairdryer. It was your act of plugging it in. It was your act of leaving it plugged in that resulted in these damages. The landlord had no control over this, has no control over your hairdryer. You're responsible."
Counsel, is there anything in the record to indicate a more precise nature of the cause of the fire? Was it something defective in the hair dryer? Was it something defective in the wiring of the building? Is that in the record?
Yes. In terms of the stipulated facts and in terms of the police report and the fire report, it is undisputed that the sole cause of the fire was the hair dryer it was not the result of defective wiring. And for the court's ruling today, the ruling should be based upon the fact that it was the hairdryer that caused the fire. In deference to the tenant, it was also...
Do we know anything about how? I mean, people leave... I think it's fairly well taken that people leave various appliances plugged in their homes on a regular basis. We can think of televisions, we can think of clock radios, we can think of... We can add infinite. Was there something about this particular hairdryer that caused the fire?
Without unfairly adding to the record, I will respond to your question.
Yes.
Hair dryers, although I don't use one.
The court will take judicial notice of that.
Hair dryers come with tags on them that say, honestly, not to leave them plugged in. Hair dryers have been known to spontaneously, when they're left plugged in, to cause fire. I do not want the ruling today, I do not want to be unfair to Attorney
Connell. Is that in the record?
Pardon me?
Is that in the record? That hair dryers come with a notification that they shouldn't be left plugged in?
It is not in the record.
Okay, thank you.
What is in the record, in the answer to Justice Gableman's question, is the fact that it is conclusive that it was the hair dryer that spontaneously caused the fire.
I appreciate you clearing that up, because the way I read the report, it said it was the act of leaving the hairdryer plugged in, and to me that just sort of begged the question, but I appreciate you clearing that up.
So then the issue before this court is whether or not the lease of the landlord should be voided out in terms of its provision that said that if, for any cause, the resulting damages were as a result of an act of the tenant, then under this specific provision cited by counsel for the tenant, that lease provision should be void.
Counsel?
My response is no. Yes, Chief Justice.
A side issue. Does your insurance cover this?
My understanding, I'm not trying to...
Can I ask this is because it comes up in the amicus brief. Go ahead.
Okay. My understanding is that this either fell within the deductible...
Okay.
...or was not enough to present to the insurance company because of the size of the damage.
Because fire generally covers everything other than arson.
It's a very good question from another perspective, though.
Yep.
Because were the court to accept the ruling and finding of the appellate court, and if, in fact, there was sufficient insurance of the landlord to cover this act, as the justices on this court are well aware, the insurance company would pay the claim of the landlord, and then they would be subrogated to the rights of the landlord, and they, in fact, would have a right to pursue the tenant. So the insurance company then would be right back before this court on the very same issue. Is this tenant, as a result of her act, with no negligence, liable for the fire in question? And we submit no. The main thrust of our arguments is that the Court of Appeals, in its ruling, indicated that the statute provided that the only basis upon which a tenant can be held liable under the requisite specific position provision of 704.07 is if there is a finding of negligence. And I would submit to this court that that's not what that statute says. The word only isn't even in that statute. That statute is suggestive in nature of certain areas of law that are well-founded, but it should not be interpreted by the court to be all-inclusive. This court has previously indicated that remedies for a breach of lease may, in fact, exist outside of Wisconsin Statute Section 704.07. Laska versus Steinpass. 69 was second, number 307 on the second page says that they can sue for diminished value if the resulting act was outside of 704.07.
Counsel, one of the areas of inquiry for me in the statute is with regard to the untenability. That's why I asked for clarification initially from you. And I look at the statute, 704.07 sub 4, untenability. The Court of Appeals interpreted that statute in paragraph 8 of the Court of Appeals opinion, and it said, Wisconsin Statute 704074 carves out an exception, etc. I'm looking at the second sentence of that paragraph. Consequently, the landlord is obligated to repair any damages caused by the fire if the building becomes uninhabitable unless the tenant's negligence or improper use was the cause of the fire. That's their interpretation. So I want to take a look at that sub 4. And it starts out, and do you have that in front of you?
I do.
Okay, good. I don't want to.
Not a problem.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. Untenability. It says, if the premises becomes untenable because of damage by fire. And that's what we have here, apparently. It's become untenable because of damage by fire. And then I will say dot, 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 because water and other stuff isn't relevant. The tenant may remove from the premises unless the landlord proceeds promptly to repair or rebuild or eliminates dot, dot, dot. The very last sentence of that section says this doesn't apply if the damage or condition is caused by negligence. So in reading that, it seems to me that this must apply because it deals with fire and because it's this case facts involve non-negligence of the tenant. That's the last sentence. So this applies, and this section apparently anticipates the landlord proceeding to prompt repair or rebuilding. How does that mesh with your argument that the statute, when there's a fire and when there is no negligence of the tenant, that the landlord has no duty to repair?
Because in this circumstance, the fire was caused by an act of the tenant and by a circumstance not in the control of the landlord. It was the tenant's act of plugging in the hairdryer.
Let me
expand that.
That involves, I guess, the lease. And your comments earlier, and I took them down verbatim, is that the hairdryer was the sole cause of the accident in response to questions from the bench regarding the police report, that it was the sole cause. So how does that tie into 3.6 of the lease, which reads in part, and equipment thereto in any way caused by the acts of the lessee? I think that's what you're referring to. Is that what you're referring to?
My response, Justice Bradley, in terms of the hairdryer being the sole cause, was in response to the question asked by Justice Gableman, could it possibly have been as a result of defective wiring? And my response, as indicated, was no, it wasn't as a result of defective wiring. It was the hairdryer.
And then you went on to say the court should be controlled by the fact that it was the hairdryer that caused the fire.
It was the hairdryer that caused the fire, but by making that statement both in response to Justice Gableman and in any argument that I've made, should not be interpreted by this court to mean that merely the hairdryer was at fault. It took an act of the tenant to plug in the hairdryer to result in this fire. Keep in mind that in today's day and age, we have hair dryers, we have computer systems, stereo systems. We hear about cases every day, cars being parked in tenants' garages, that unbeknownst and because of a defect in the defect in wiring or a defect in something in the product, they spontaneously cause fires. That's not negligence per se on the part of the tenant, but it is as a result of an appliance, a car, in this case a hairdryer, a television set of the tenant that results in a problem. Now, from a policy perspective,
would it be correct to say then there's a strict liability for the tenant? I mean, after all, the tenant brought the hairdryer into the building.
I view strict liability in the contents of a negligence case. I do not view strict liability or the terminology and case law behind
okay.
that in the context of a contract case.
Not using it as a term of art in negligence, but is it your position that the client or the tenant is strictly liable?
Absolute liability.
Absolute liability. Okay. Thank
it is,
you.
Yeah, it is my position that the tenant is contractually liable according to the express terms of the contract, which make the tenant liable.
The contract makes the tenant absolutely liable.
Under the circumstances that are in the control of the tenant, yes, that is my conclusion. The policy behind this is very broad and very dramatic, as will be argued by my co-counsel.
Would you be making the same argument if she did not have it plugged in, but of course she's the one that brought it in, and some way it was next to something that caused some other problem?
If it was as a result of something out of the control of the landlord, my answer would be yes. My time is up.
Okay, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Wynn. Mr. Kowski.
Morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Clay Kosky, and I'm with Michael Best and Friedrich here in Madison, along with my co-counsel, Bill White, also of Michael Best in Madison. And we represent Amici Apartment Association of South Central Wisconsin, Southeastern Wisconsin, Central Wisconsin Apartment Association, and Lakeshore Apartment Association.
Do each of them have the form contract you set forth in your amicus brief?
No, that would actually be Apartment Association of South Central Wisconsin here in Dane County.
Others use different forms.
Correct.
Anybody use the Maryland? Is it Maryland? The Maryland Arms form?
Not that I'm aware of. I'd also.
Is anyone else? What about the other associations? This is any North West Association of Apartment?
Not that I'm aware of, Chief Justice.
Is this it, then, of all the apartment associations that you know of?
Of those that I know of that we represent, I'm not aware of any of them using the Maryland Arms lease or distributing it as the South Central Wisconsin has distributed this form lease. Before I get started,
Have you reviewed the lease that's at issue here?
I have.
Do you think paragraph 3.6 is unambiguous?
I think it is unambiguous.
All right, and why so?
I think it plainly states that that any damages caused by the tenant or the tenants, let me pull it out in front of you before I'm
sure.
Speaking about it. I think it is clear and unambiguous, and I, Justice Rogensack, I'm not sure if you're getting at the issue that the Court of Appeals raised with regard to the first couple sentences versus the remainder of the section 3.6?
Well, you know, there is a part in the lease that says you don't use the headings. The headings are descriptive, but they're not the obligations. That's in paragraph 4 point something or the other. I'm looking at 3.6, and the first sentence talks about intentional or negligent acts. Okay. The second sentence doesn't use the word negligent or intentional acts. And I understand that at least initially, not counting the amended complaint, which named a lot of other paragraphs in the lease, this is what was relied on by the landlord. Now, I also note that there was a minimal security deposit of a couple $100s here, and section 2.3 says that the landlord has the right to deduct from the security deposit damages, normal wear and tear excepted. So when I look at the lease, I look at the whole thing to try to figure out, well, what did the parties think they were agreeing to here? Did they think they were agreeing to this kind of a damage caused by leaving a hairdryer plugged in, and everyone agrees nobody knew there was a problem with the hairdryer, so there wasn't negligence. You can say it's an intentional act, because obviously you have to intend to plug it in, but I don't think that's generally what's meant by an intentional act that causes damages. So, you know, I guess my concern is, was this really unambiguous? Did the tenant and the guarantor really think they were binding themselves to this kind of a thing? I mean, what if the toilet backed up and they used it for the normal purposes? Would they be liable? What if the TV decided to catch on fire? I never unplug my TV. I mean, maybe people do. When I go to a hotel, hair dryers are uniformly plugged in when you get there in the bathroom, if they provide one. It's hung on the wall, it's plugged in the wall. So, you know, my concern is, if this was clearly what they agreed to, then fine. But if it wasn't, I have some concerns about that. So that's really what my question is directed at. Now, you think it's unambiguous, and why don't you explain to me your position on that?
I think it is unambiguous, and I think that my conclusion is bolstered by a case that we've cited in our brief, which is a case from the Michigan Court of Appeals decided in 2007, the Laurel Woods versus Rumaya case, which included lease terms which are very similar to this provision, under facts which were also quite similar to this case. I think if you look at the terms in this lease, and I want to comment on what I thought you might have been getting at, Justice Rogensack, with regard to the Court of Appeals concerns about the way that 3.6 is phrased. You have a sentence in the beginning saying, lessee shall be responsible for all intentional and negligent acts or breaches of this lease by lessee, so forth, period. Mm-hmm. Lessee shall be liable for all damage to the premises and appliances and equipment belonging to them in any way caused by the acts of lessee. And because there's a period there, I think that it's two separate thoughts. The second sentence creates, you know, an unambiguous liability for damages that are caused by that tenant or the tenant's guests. That's why I think it's unambiguous. I think that had there not been that period between the first and second sentences, it's possible that there might have been some question about whether negligence or intentional were in some way modified by, in any way caused by.
Well, why do you need the first sentence if you interpret the second sentence to mean
right,
the tenant is absolutely liable, which is really what you're saying,
right,
for any damage caused by the tenant's act, regardless of negligence or intentional?
Exactly, Chief Justice. I don't think you need the first sentence. I think to hold the tenant liable here, you only need the second sentence.
Yeah, but usually in interpreting a contract, you say you give effect to everything, and you don't make any of them redundant. And if they are redundant, then you have to ask why.
I don't think it's redundant, Chief Justice, respectfully, because it's talking about caused by versus intentional and negligent acts or breaches. And I know in negligent acts you get into causation as well. So I can see where you're drawing some redundancy there. But respectfully, I think the second sentence is very clear. In any way caused by means in any way caused by. And that's the position that the amici would take.
I think that the second sentence expands the kinds of acts you're talking about. And they're talking about acts that could have been done by an occupant, a guest, or an invitee, which isn't in the first sentence, but it doesn't, to my reading, change the kind of acts that were caused by the tenant. And my concern is, reading that paragraph, would you really conclude that negligent and intentional acts of the tenant cause liability, and non-negligent acts of a tenant cause liability?
I think you would. I think that because of the unique factual and procedural posture of this case, it's actually almost like a law school hypothetical to me. You have stipulated facts where the parties have stipulated that this damage was caused by the hairdryer and that Ms. Connell plugged it in. It's very unusual, and that's one of the three things that I want the court to recognize. Number one, the court in this decision has to preserve the party's right to freedom of contract. Number two, the court needs to recognize that this case does not involve negligence or improper use by the tenant. And the third takeaway that the court should have from this argument is that the court needs to limit its decision to these unique facts, again, not involving negligence or improper use, to avoid unintended negative consequences for landlords, dealing with the insurability of losses and voiding of lease provisions or even entire leases. And just to briefly touch on that, because it's important, I want to raise it in the time I have. In 2001, this court decided the Byrell versus McTaggart case, in which it held that a landlord inserted a lease provision providing for attorney's fees. And in that case, this court determined that that provision was not severable and that the entire lease was unenforceable as to that landlord. And one of the concerns that amici have is that this court's decision, although in this case it may not choose to void the entire lease, it could adopt the Court of Appeals decision and decide that this provision is void, which would provide a precedent in a subsequent decision to possibly void the entire lease. And that's one of the concerns we have here. We don't want to see that happen. And we think the Court of Appeals took an unnecessary step in determining that provision was in fact void. I'd like to echo the comments that were made by Attorney Nguyen regarding the Court of Appeals adding the word only to the statute. The word only is not part of the statute. The word only is not found in the beginning of the language of 70407 sub 2, 3, or 4. And the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, in multiple paragraphs, in fact, in one paragraph, it adds the word only and then directly quotes the statute after the word only, as if it's part of the statute. And this is, I think this is error.
How do you respond to my concern about subsection 4? That is, it deals with a fire. It deals with a fire that is not caused by the it applies when the fire is not caused by the negligence of the tenant. And it says that the if it's uninhabitable, the landlord shall repair or must repair.
Mm-hmm. I think I have two responses to that, Justice Bradley, and I see my time is out. May I briefly conclude, Chief
Respond,
Justice?
Please.
Number one, I think that we need to look at the entirety of the statute and see that 70407 sub 2 is the statute that creates duties for landlords. So clearly the legislature intended to create duties in that part of the statute. When you look at 70407 sub 4, it doesn't state that it's creating any duties. And it's completely different than the language of 70407 sub 2. In fact, 70407 sub 4 simply allows the tenant the option to remove or to abate rent. And although it speaks in terms of the landlord repairing, it gives the tenant the option to do those things when the landlord does not repair. It doesn't say that the landlord has an affirmative duty.
Well, but Council 4 changes the common law. Under the common law, the landlord had no duty to repair, and the tenant had to continue paying rent. 4 says no deal. Tenant can needn't pay the rent, and the landlord has the duty to repair.
And Chief Justice, respectfully, I think that the way that I would read it is that the landlord has a duty to repair that creates an option for the tenant to remove or abate rent. It doesn't create an affirmative duty for the landlord to always repair under these circumstances.
Well, or said another way, the landlord has a duty to repair if the landlord wants to collect rent.
I agree, Justice Gableman.
And this here's an issue. Assuming you can agree on what the lease means, and assuming that the lease means that the tenant is liable for any damage that the tenant causes by the tenant's act, you have in the statute provisions that relate to what happens when there's negligence by the tenant, what happens when there's negligence by the landlord. I think that's right. But what is the statute is silent as to where the tenant is not negligent. Correct?
Correct, Chief Justice.
So what do you draw from the statute where it is silent?
I'm sorry.
The commentary, what was this, a judicial council or legislative council act? The comment is, the policy of the statute is impose a greater duty on the landlord. Generally worded clauses in the lease should not be construed to override the statute. That's the legislative intent. Legislature had all that in front of them, right?
That's right, Chief Justice. And the way I would respond to that is that in addition to that policy, which is in a judicial council note, we have a policy stated in the statute itself, okay, which says in 704.03(1), and this is the last sentence, Sections 704.05 and 704.07 govern as to matters within the scope of such sections, and as you indicated, non-negligence is not in those sections,
right,
and not provided for in such written lease or contract. Therefore, I would read this, another way of putting it would be to say, if 704.07 does not apply, and you have facts that the lease does apply to, that the lease should control. And that's expressly stated in the statute. It's not in a judicial council note. This is in something that the legislature enacted that's before the court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. James B. Connell, representing Carl M. and Linda Connell.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Connell, and I represent Carrie and her mother, Linda. When the Milwaukee Fire Department prepared an incident report of their work in putting out the fire in this apartment, they used a multi-page form that's part of the record in this case. And one of those pages of that form included a checklist of human factors contributing to the fire. And on that checklist, only one box was marked. It was a box labeled none. The fire department answered one of the essential questions in this case. The damage to this apartment was not caused by human factors, it was not caused by Carrie. There's been some discussion of the provisions of this paragraph 3.6 and what it means. And I believe that the lease provision, which is one paragraph, two sentences, means something different than my opponents in this case mean. The first section says that the lessee, the first section seems to assign responsibility. It says the lessee shall be responsible for all intentional and negligent acts or breaches of this lease by lessee, lessee's occupants, guests, and invitees. The second sentence seems to tell the parties what the tenant is liable for if he or she breaches the duties set forth in the first sentence. It says, lessee shall be liable for all damage to the premises and appliances and equipment belonging thereto in any way caused by the acts of lessee, lessee's occupants, guests, and invitees. I believe the two sentences should be read together. If you read them together, and you apply the common rules of contract construction, the only reasonable conclusion that I think can be reached from this lease is that the acts referred to in the second sentence are the acts which the lease assigns tenant responsibilities to in the first sentence, intentional, negligent acts, breaches of the lease. Court of Appeals felt that that was the interpretation because they read the judicial council comments to section 70407, which provides that generally worded clauses should not be construed to override the statute. I believe you could apply other commonly used rules of contract construction to come to the same conclusion. First of all, there's the rule, and I cite the Latin term nascitur or socius, I believe is the pronunciation, that the meaning of a word shall be known by its accompanying words. When the paragraph uses acts in the second sentence, it's referring to the intentional and negligent acts that it refers to in the first sentence. There's also a rule that particularization followed by general expression is ordinarily restricted to the former.
Counselor, do you think the provision is ambiguous or unambiguous?
Well, I frankly believe that that provision applies only to intentional and negligent acts. But of course, if it's ambiguous, I think that it has to be construed against the landlord. This is a form pre-printed lease drafted by the landlord and between parties where there's a significant disparity in bargaining power. The other potential problem, I believe, with ambiguity in those two sentences is this whole question of cause that we've talked about. The landlords apparently contend that Kerry caused the fire, although the hairdryer apparently caused the fire. Kerry didn't cause it. The plugging in the hairdryer didn't cause it. Bringing the hairdryer into the apartment didn't cause the fire. You know, as a practical matter, legal responsibilities should be limited to those causes that are connected with the result and are of such significance that the law is justified in imposing liability. We don't have a definition of cause in this case. The landlord seems to assume that the cause that we're talking about in this lease is a kind of a but-for cause. That is, but for the fact that you brought the hairdryer into the apartment, this fire would not have occurred. But that is not the type of cause that is usually used in the legal setting, and it certainly shouldn't be used in this case.
Does this I've been looking at this language in any way caused by the acts of the lease. This is the language I referenced opposing counsel in when asking a question. In any way caused, and of course I always, when I see the word cause, I think of, is it a cause or the cause? But your best interpretation of acts in the second sentence refers to the acts contemplated in the first sentence. But what about in any way cause? Is it in any way was a cause, or is any way was the cause, or what's your best interpretation of that, or neither?
Well, you know, I think that cause ought to be used in its usual legal, the way it's used in the usual legal setting. That is, that it ought to be a cause that's closely connected with the result and a cause that's of such significance that the law is justified in imposing liability. And I think bringing a hairdryer into an apartment or plugging it in isn't one of those acts of such significance. Now, again, I was asked earlier about whether this is ambiguous. I suspect it is. And I suspect that the way it ought to be interpreted is against the landlord, for the reasons I've stated before. I think if you interpret the lease the way I think it should be interpreted, you don't even have to talk about 70407. But I think the Court of Appeals was correct that section governs in this case. And one of the sections that hasn't been mentioned that I think is instructive is under the duties of the landlord in subsection 2A5C of section 704.07. It says, if the premises are damaged by fire, water, or other casualty, not the result of the negligence or intentional act of the landlord, this subsection is inapplicable and either subsection 3 or 4 governs. The statute does not say that this section is inapplicable and either subsection 3 or 4 governs or the parties are free to contract otherwise, which apparently is the argument of the landlords in this case. I think that this section of the statute is a clear indication that the Court of Appeals was right, that when you get to the next section, subsection 3, that is the only way that liability can attach to a tenant. Tenants are only responsible for damage caused by negligence or improper use. And that interpretation is further buttressed by, and this has been discussed before, subsection 4. It says basically that fire damage not caused by the negligence or improper use of the tenant must be repaired by the landlord or the tenant may remove. I believe that covers fire damage and that there is no supplement to this statute. That covers fire damage like the fire damage in this case, which was caused by a hairdryer. It would cover fire damage caused by some natural disaster, lightning. It would cover fire damage caused by some intruder, a burglar starting a fire. This section is the exclusive means, in my view, of allocating the duty of repair in residential tenancies.
Could I ask, let's suppose we have a tenant who, a relative of the tenant, visits and stays in the apartment. And that visitor is negligent. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. But the visitor is negligent at a time when the tenant isn't even present.
Well, I think that the judicial comments to this statute would cover that situation. And this is what the comments say. The statutory language refers to negligence or improper use of the premises by the tenant. However, under normal rules of agency, the tenant may be charged with the acts of his agents. Under certain circumstances, he would also be responsible if the improper use of the premises were by his own family and even by invited guests. So I think that covers the situation that you raise, Your Honor. But again, the comment to Section 4, which has been mentioned before, is at common law, the tenant bore the risk of a fire or any other casualty loss. The comments say such a rule was too harsh, and many states, including New York and Wisconsin, changed the rule by statute, and that statute that applies in this case is Section 704.07. The allocation of responsibility, I'm sorry.
Oh, you go ahead. I want to let you finish your thought. I thought you were done.
The allocation of responsibility to repair because of fire is a requirement of Section 704.07, and according to the first section of the statute, it cannot be waived, and any agreement to waive the allocation of responsibility is void.
So you're saying that the lease could add some additional language to cover visitors?
Yes. I mean, I think, again, the judicial comments say that under the normal rules of agency would apply to visitors, yes.
But what about, suppose the visitors brought in hair dryers or extra electrical equipment, and I mean, they weren't really negligent, but they overtaxed the facilities.
But I think, I believe that negligence and improper use of the premises are the sole basis for fixing responsibility on a tenant.
The
tenant's guests and so forth.
You're saying that the second sentence of the lease, whatever that provision is, it is really just an amplification of the first sentence.
That's what I believe.
Okay. But now, you assert that, I assume the opposing counsel assert otherwise, how do we determine what the correct answer is?
Well, I think we use the usual rules of contract construction. That is, that you read this provision of the lease as a whole. That you determine the meaning of the word act in the second sentence by the accompanying words negligent and intentional in the first sentence. And you adopt not only the judicial counsel admonition that general words should not be used to, generally worded clauses should not be used to override the statute, and the rule of contract construction that particularization followed by a general statement was ordinarily applied to the former.
And can you resort to the title of that section? I mean, there's no reference to negligence in the title of that lease section.
No, and again, I think that the title is not part of the lease provision, and I think there's a provision in the lease, I can't cite it to you, that says that, actually.
Mr. Connell, if the lease was interpreted in that second second sentence to say that it covers acts of the lessee, acts of the tenant, that were not intentional or negligent, and that there's, you interpret it to mean absolute liability if you can have a connect the dots to the tenant, like the tenant here plugged in the hairdryer. If the sentence was so interpreted, do you think it violates 70407?
Yes.
So it would have to fall.
It would have to fall.
If you want to save, in your opinion, if you wanted to save that sentence, it has to be more narrowly interpreted.
That's correct. I think there's an alternate way of looking at that. And if you look at it the way the landlord contends it should be read, it's void.
It's void under sub 2, which you read as these are the only duties of the tenant.
Subsection 2 says, yes, it says that.
That's a landlord.
It refers to the landlord's duties, but it says that if the premises are damaged by fire, water, other casualty,
right,
not the result of the negligence or intentional act of the tenant,
that's
this subsection is inapplicable, and either
right,
the other two sections govern.
Well, I'm sorry. Your interpretation of sub 3, the duty of the tenant, is that's the only duties of the tenant, period.
Yes.
Counselor, I want to ask...
In residential tenancies.
Right.
I want to ask you a question that troubles me, and I would have you look at 70403 sub 1.
Sorry, I don't have that.
70 what? 4?
It's 70403 sub 1. And I'm really just looking at the last sentence of that subsection. And essentially what it says is if the conduct you're looking at doesn't fall within 70405 or 70407, then clearly there can be lease provisions that fall outside of those sections, at least as I read the statute. And I think the argument on the other side is this is a lease provision that falls outside of those sections.
Can you respond
to that provision and how you think it ties into your argument that this lease provision can't be upheld just because it doesn't seem to comply with what's in 70407?
Well, I believe that section 70407, and I think the judicial comments would support this position, is the exclusive way of allocating the duty to repair in residential leases. I think that's why when they refer to the landlord's duty, that they say if the premises are damaged by fire, not the result of the negligence or intentional act of the landlord, either 3 or 4 govern. So I think you either look at subsection 2 for the duties of the landlord, subsection 3 for the duties of the tenant, and subsection 4 in those situations, like the situation here, where the premises was rendered uninhabitable, and where the last section of subsection 4 says this subsection is inapplicable to the, pardon me, this subsection is inapplicable if the damage or condition is caused by negligence or improper use by the tenant. I think that means that it is applicable except in cases of damage or condition caused by negligence or improper use of the tenant.
So essentially what you're saying is if there's any provision in a lease that I might think would fall in 704.03 sub 1, that it can't be valid if it in any way affects an obligation of a tenant in regard to repair.
Duty of repair, yes. You know, Your Honor, the case of Laska versus Steinprice was cited earlier. I wrote briefs in that case back in 1974 for the landlord, but that case didn't deal with the allocation of the duty to repair. There was no question in that case that the tenant had the duty of repair because of his negligence and improper use of the premises. The only question in that case is, what was the remedy for violating the duty of repair? We had tried that case on the theory of a diminishment of value of this. It was an agricultural lease in a farm. The tenant on appeal said, well, you can only get the cost of repair. And the Supreme Court sided with the landlord in that case.
So if I agree with you, I have to disagree that there's a freedom of contract that's in any way protected by 704.03 sub 1, right?
Yes.
So there are some things you can't contract to. That's exactly what you said.
That's correct. And I think when this statute was enacted back in the 1960s, the Attorney General commented in a report to the legislature on this issue of freedom of contract, and said, and this is their report, today there is considerable support for the position that a residential lease is not purely a matter of private interest governed by freedom of contract principles, but rather superseded by the interests and welfare of the public. And I think that was the basis for the enactment of Chapter 704.
Counsel, do you think the use of the phrase duty to repair or repair the damage is the same as the requirement to pay for the repairs and always be the one solely responsible for payment of the repairs?
I think it's implicit in the use of the language. I don't think a tenant, for instance, could damage property by improper use or negligence, arrange for the repair, and send the bill to the landlord.
I want to be clear on that, because what if the tenant is negligent but isn't the only one who's negligent? What if there's some shared responsibility? Or what if the landlord's negligent but not solely negligent? I mean, one of them ought to repair it because you have to make the place tenable, but what do you do if there should be a division of damages? That's where I'm a little bit stuck, because it always talks about repairing it. You know, get the place up and running, get somebody back in their room, right?
Yes.
That's kind of the goal here. So whose responsibility is it? If the tenant's negligent, the tenant does it. If the landlord's negligent, the landlord does it. Those are easy scenarios. But what if the tenant's negligent, but not the only one negligent?
Well, I think that, of course, in this case, the landlord, for good reasons, didn't allege negligence, but I think in negligence cases, we would apply the typical rules of negligence, that is the contributory, the apportionment, comparative negligence.
And okay, so there are scenarios where the tenant is not solely responsible for the payment. Is that what you're saying? I'm trying to figure out if repair the damage means the same as repair and pay for, and no one else contributes to that.
Well, I think if you read the statute as whole, the landlord is responsible for damages caused by his negligence. The tenant is responsible for damages caused by his or her negligence. And I think if both were negligent, you could certainly compare negligence. But in this case, we're talking about a contract term, and if a tenant and his guests were negligent, as I said before, I think the tenant would be on the hook because of the rules of agency.
Counsel, when I was a tenant, I had tenant's liability insurance. Would that cover here, or don't you?
Well, I think it would, and I wish it had, because if it was, there'd be some insurance company standing up here and making the argument that I am making today. This is a case where it seems to me both parties ought to have insurance. You know, one of the commentators commented on the Court of Appeals decision said that it's unfortunate that our courts need to decide the issue presented in this case. Why did the landlord not simply recover its loss from its casualty insurance policy on the apartment building? And this author goes on to advocate a sort of a no-fault type of provision in leases. This approach saves the human and financial costs of litigation and scarce court resources. But that isn't the case here. And, you know, in commercial leases, you probably wouldn't hear this type of argument because now, as I understand it, in most commercial leases, the tenant, the landlord, and their insurers agree to mutual waivers of subrogation, so there's never an argument like the one presented in this case. And I hope this case is decided so you won't be back here trying to decide in the future questions of cause and so forth in a residential tenancy.
This Court of Appeals decision favors you. Is there anything you'd like to see changed in that Court of Appeals decision?
No.
Just adopt it verbatim.
That would be fine with me, Your Honor.
That's checking, Counsel.
Counsel, when I read subsection 4, the express language to me appears to run to the duty, or as opposing counsel put it, the option of tenant to withhold or abate rent in its portions of rent or rent in its entirety, dependent on whether the landlord immediately undertakes to repair. Can you help me understand? I think you made reference a few minutes ago that you thought it was implicit in there that the landlord bears the financial burden for the repairs as well. But I think it's fairly said that the express language of subsection 4 seems to relate most particularly to the tenant's obligation to pay rent. Can you help me understand the next?
Well, I think we all know where the section came from. Lots of times you rent a house and the house burns down and the landlord then has the decision, am I going to rebuild or am I not? And in this case, we were, I think it's one unit in a 41 unit building, so I don't think the landlord really was faced with that kind of choice. They had to repair, and as long as the damage was not caused by negligence or improper use, it is a landlord's responsibility under that section, I believe.
Let me go once more. If the lease is not ambiguous, if you just assume that for the moment, it is invalid as a result of what particular provision of 70407?
Well, 70407 says an agreement to waive the requirements of this section in a residential tenancy is void. That's in subsection 1. Subsection 3 provides that if the premises are damaged by the negligence or improper use of the premise by the tenant must repair. Subsection 4 provides that if the premises is rendered uninhabitable or untenable, by reason of fire damage, the landlord must repair or permit the tenant to remove. In this case, the landlord repaired but seeks to charge the tenant for the cost of repair, and I think that violates this section. Just as if the tenant damaged the property by negligence or improper use and then sent the bill to the landlord.
When the tenant moves out of an apartment, if there's damage to the premises, that's going to be deducted from the security deposit normally. But the landlord isn't going to have to prove negligence as the cause of that damage. But
I believe that damage to the premises must be caused by negligence or improper use. I don't believe that a tenant is an insurer of the property. And if the building was burglarized and damaged by burglars and there was no negligence on the part of either landlord or tenant, then the tenant would not be under a legal obligation to repair the premises. And the tenant, the landlord, would not be required or would not be allowed to deduct damage from security deposit.
If there's damage to a premises during the time that the tenant is living in the premises, how does the landlord prove the damage was caused by negligence?
Well, I think in most cases it's quite clear. If there's a hole the size of a fist in the door, you know that was improper use of the premises. One of the cases that cited it somewhere in the briefs is a case of wear and tear, and you know that case said that the principles in this case about negligence or improper use do not apply because there's a specific provision on wear and tear, and if you go beyond ordinary wear and tear, the tenant is liable. There's a specific provision on that in section 70407.
Isn't the converse of your response to the first part of Justice Prosser's question that when you said, well, that would make the tenant the insurer of the landlord's premises, the converse of that would be, it seems the argument, the position you're taking might make the landlord the insurer of every appliance that a tenant brings into the residence.
I believe unless there's evidence of negligence or improper use, the landlord's obligation is to repair fire damage, whether it's caused by lightning or a hairdryer. The red light's on, so thank you for listening.
Mr. Connell? Mr. Wynn?
There's been a lot of talk about burglars, about lightning, toilets, and in each one of these circumstances, one thing jumps into my head. Whose toilet? Who is in control? This case, in my opinion, boils down to one concept. Who is in control of the item that caused the problem? Obviously, the tenant isn't in control of the lightning or the burglar. Obviously, if it's a defective toilet, that is the landlord's toilet. The tenant, likewise, is not in control of that. How else is a landlord going to, through his contract, protect himself in these circumstances from items or appliances that are brought into the landlord's premises by a tenant? The suggestion has been made that when you deduct from a security deposit, Do you have to scrutinize every item of deduction and say, well, you know, this one wasn't caused by negligence, so, well, I guess I can't deduct from the security deposit?
Doesn't 704 allow for normal wear and tear and things that are above normal wear and tear or
yes.
either improper use or negligence?
It does, absolutely. Yeah. Much talk has also been, many questions have also been asked about the two sentences set forth in the lease in 3.6. The first sentence is merely a restatement of the law. The second sentence is in addition to the law. This law, Chapter 704, is not the be-all and end-all. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the legislature could write a law that covers every single circumstance in a landlord-tenant relationship? It doesn't work that way. This month actually marks the 31st year that I've been doing this, and I've been involved in landlord-tenant law and landlord-tenant litigation for 31 years. And I can assure you that circumstances such as this and other matters occur outside the scope of the statute on a regular basis. There was a reference to Wisconsin Statute Section 704.03 sub 1. That supports the landlord's position as well, from the context of that. Under 704.03 sub 1, it says that, and it infers, and it very clearly states that if the parties to a lease are allowed to contractually agree to circumstances not provided for under 704.05 and 704.07.
Does that mean it has to be expressly provided for? What goes through my mind is this. A lot of our cases here involve statutory construction. What does the statute mean? And every once in a while, we'll have a statute, and does the statute govern? You know, and we have a statute that is clear on its face. But generally, if it's so clear on its face, it doesn't come to us. You know, it's resolved in the lower courts. And so we look at the statute that doesn't expressly say something that covers in the case, and we look at the words we have in a case called Kalal, the blueprint of how we interpret what the statute means. Look at the words, and if it's clear, as I said, everyone can go home, but oftentimes it doesn't get here if it's so clear. If it's not so clear what it means, we look at context, we look at legislative history, we look at scope, and so we use all of these tools to try to define and determine what the statute means when it is not expressly stated. So I don't think you have to have it expressly stated. I think you have to interpret what the statute means. It doesn't have to be expressed, does it? Expressly stated?
I wholeheartedly agree. And in conjunction with that, I would submit to you that the statutes being relied upon have nothing to do with this case. Chapter 704. The sub 4, the statute being cited for fire. That statute is very clear on its face. It has nothing to do with this case. It has nothing to do with this case because but for the act of this tenant to introduce into this unit the hair dryer that caused the fire, we wouldn't be here. In conclusion, a landlord's going to hand over keys to a tenant where the court, or if this court affirms the lower court's decision, the Court of Appeals decision, it would be tantamount to a landlord handing over the keys, says, welcome to my building, but we don't want you to bring any appliances into the building. We don't want you to have a hairdryer. We don't want you to have a TV or a computer that may ultimately be defective. We'll provide the heat. We'll provide the light. Have a good day. See you around. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Nguyen and Mr. Kowalski and Mr. Connell, for your arguments in a landlord-tenant case that affects many people in the state of Wisconsin, many people who own and rent property and those who don't own and are tenants. So ends the hearing on 08 AP 1700, Maryland Arms Limited Partnership versus Carrie Connell. The court is recessed and will return at 1:30 for its third case.